Welcome to the podcast of Media Matters with Bob McChesney, a weekly show on media from WILL Radio. Visit us at will.uiuc.edu.
Greetings. Welcome to Media Matters today, March 12, 2006, here in beautiful Champaign-Urbana on WILL AM 580. Today, our guests are going to be Michael Bracey, who is a partner in Bracey Tucker Brown in Washington, D.C., and a co-founder of the Future of Music Coalition. And we'll be joined later in the program by the executive director of the Future of Music Coalition, Jenny Toomey, who in her busy schedule now, I guess, is on her way to the airport. So she will be joining us during the program, we hope. But we do have Michael with us right now. Michael, are you there?
I am, Bob. How are you?
I'm doing great, and it's a pleasure to have you on the air with us. Future of Music Coalition has been one of the leading groups representing and advocating the rights and obligations due to musicians, representing musicians' interest. Could you tell our listeners here at WILL AM 580 a little bit more of Future of Music Coalition? Because I suspect if you're not a working musician, you might not know about the group.
Sure. No, I appreciate that. Future Music Coalition was founded almost 6 years ago around the basic idea that the traditional structures of the music industry were fundamentally broken, that they just didn't work. They didn't serve musicians, and they didn't serve listeners or consumers. And that technology and emerging technologies were, by definition, going to fundamentally change and challenge those traditional structures. And what Future Music has set out to do for the last 6 years is to both work to identify and reform these traditional structures that we consider to be flawed. So what I mean by that is the major label system or sort of the underlying corruption of a consolidated radio marketplace, and also to really try to encourage the conversation around what technology can and should do to really create a much more just and functioning music economy and music community. So our work involves research, it involves education, direct advocacy, hosting events and convenings, and really trying to, as I said, both kind of reform the old structures and really have this conversation about what the future could and should hold.
Now, Michael Bracey, what is the nature of the music recording industry today? How many firms are there? How has it changed over the last few years?
Well, there's a lot of talk and a lot of hype about sort of, peer-to-peer file trading and the digital revolution in music and iTunes. And what sometimes is a little bit underreported is that at the first part, the first digital revolution was the way that technology has sort of opened up the tools of creation, that historically it cost a tremendous amount of money to actually be able to go into a recording studio and create a professional sounding piece of music. And so the first, sort of level of revolution here is that, hundreds of thousands, literally hundreds of thousands of songwriters and musicians have now had the tools of creation made available to them because of digital technologies. And so what you see is, an industry where you have sort of at the top of it, you have four major labels, which are part of huge sort of international conglomerates, entertainment conglomerates that are into all sorts of other media and entertainment-related businesses.
Who are these four groups that you're talking about?
It's Warner Brothers, which actually, Warner Music, which actually was part of the AOL Time Warner mess and then actually was divested. They split that off. So that is Warner Records, which is sort of out on their own, Warner Music. Then you have Sony, which is, of course, part of Sony. You have BMG, which is part of the Bertelsmann empire. And then you have EMI, which is been kind of hanging on for a long time and is often rumored to be bought up by one of the others, and they just haven't been able to sell them yet. So you have those corporations, and they control, in America, they control roughly 72% of the economy, of the industry part of the business. Then below that, you have tens of thousands of basically what are called independent record labels, and those range from sort of the artist as an independent entrepreneur who puts out their own work and burns 2,000 CDs and sells them off their website or off of independent aggregators like CDBaby.com, things like that. And then they range up to more sort of recognized brand names like Merge Records, Touch and Go, Sub Pop, labels that have the ability to sell 70 or 80,000 records at a pop. And And what's interesting about sort of the way that the music economy is sort of evolving, the independent sector now is actually up to about 27% of market share, which is they've gone up about 10% in the last 5 years.
Yeah, that's pretty. That's a dramatic shift.
Yeah, and really what it demonstrates is, you know, how poorly served, you know, how the traditional structure of four major labels working in collusion with a consolidated radio environment and, you know, cable outlets like MTV, you know, how poorly that served consumers. Because the second wave of the digital revolution, if the first was sort of making available the tools of creation, the second wave is then the ability to promote and distribute your work via the web. And what we've seen is through websites like Pitchfork, through the emerging blogosphere, through sort of the maturation of sites like iTunes and subscription services like Rhapsody, what you see now is for the music fan. Obviously, I'm sorry, and it has to be said up front, you know, taken for granted a certain, you know, class issue where, you know, the music fan who actually has enough money to afford, you know, high-speed internet connection, things like that. But for, you know, the music fan who has the resources to have a high-speed connection and a good computer, you know, they are exposed to and have the ability to access boundless amounts of music. And they are now really starting in a very serious way to turn that into a legitimate digital economy. They're actually purchasing music either as digital files through iTunes or other services, or by purchasing hard product. So it really is an amazing demonstration and a real tangible demonstration about how technology is really challenging flawed traditional structures of that industry.
Michael Bracey, our guest today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Later in the show, we hope to be joined by Michael Bracey's partner at the Future of Music Coalition. That's Executive Director Jenny Toomey. And if you'd like to call in with a question or comment for Michael Bracey, the phone number here at Media Matters is 333-9455, the toll-free number 1-800-222-9455. Michael, as I was listening to you speak about the digital revolution, both in production and distribution of music, it occurred to me, you know, what exactly is the function of these big music companies anymore at all? I mean, if it doesn't cost a fortune to record anymore, so we don't really need to have Warner or Sony behind us to make a credible recording, and if we don't need them to manufacture our disc and distribute them, but we can distribute them digitally, what is the function of these firms that dominate the music industry?
Well, that's exactly the question, and I think that's what the industry itself is really trying to figure out. Traditionally, again, there always historically has been a certain level of corruption in the major label system, but historically, there was a role. There were really two roles that the labels played, and the first, as I mentioned before, was the bank. I mean, they put the investment capital into printing discs and getting vinyl onto trucks and getting them into stores, and it just costs a whole lot of money to do that. The second, though, and that function goes away in a digital economy. I mean, technology and, you know, really makes that piece of it moot. The second piece is where the labels have really lost their way. And the second piece was really to help take sort of iconoclastic, in some ways unusual personalities who created great art and figured out how to build these people, how to take them to the market. Basically, how do you take a Neil Young? How do you take a Joni Mitchell? How do you take a Bob Dylan? People who wanted to focus on art, wanted to focus on creation, didn't necessarily want to be business people. And so what they were able to do, what these labels were able to do, and the whole infrastructure of the music industry was able to do, is take these people and get them out in front of consumers. What's happened in the industry, and again, the record industry is so interesting because it mirrors other industries like, you know, broadcast and others. As they have transitioned from being smaller, privately held corporations, companies, into being part of massive publicly traded corporations, the business model has changed. And so the traditional model where you would want a career artist, you know, you would search for the person who'd be around for 20 years and you would build slowly, you know, what happened to Bruce Springsteen and these others, that doesn't fit now in their model. What they need, basically, to make their money work, they need to sell about 750,000 units. And so all the industry wants to do in this kind of publicly traded environment is try to find the next huge seller, you know, to see what's in the market today, how do we mimic that, how do we anticipate where the market's going. And that's why pop music today feels so disposable, because it's all based, you know, not on this idea of how do we build someone's career, and partner with them over time. It's how do we, you know, really make our numbers work to keep our stockholders happy so we can have a job next quarter.
We're talking to Michael Bracey today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Michael Bracey works with the Future of Music Coalition out of Washington, D.C., and we're talking about the state of the music industry, some of the big political fights it faces, and the future of music, as the title of his group indicates, and what's going on for musicians. We've been talking about the music industry, the recording industry. I want to turn now, if we can, Michael, and talk about the radio industry, because I know the Future of Music Coalition has spent a lot of its energy in the past several years dealing with the state of radio broadcasting. And radio, of course, is the major distribution arm for music, at least exposing people to music in this country, prospective consumers, and popularizing music to people who wouldn't hear it otherwise. What is the state of radio in the United States today, broadcasting, and how has it changed?
Well, broadcast radio is in a tremendous moment of flux. I mean, it really is quite remarkable because essentially what's happened in that industry, and again, this you see these threads that just kind of mirror each other in these different industries, but what's happened in broadcast radio is that in the last 10 years, the industry has transitioned from something that was controlled basically through regulation, was basically dominated by local ownership. You had many, many owners of radio stations spread out through local markets all around the country. And in 1996, Congress threw into the Telecommunications Act, quote-unquote, regulatory relief. Essentially, they eliminated the national cap on how many stations any one company could own. So in the last 10 years, there's been a massive restructuring of how commercial radio stations are owned in this country, to the extent now where you have 10 companies actually now with ABC Radio selling, I think, you know, nine basically companies controlling roughly two-thirds of listeners and two-thirds of advertising dollars. You know, we've lost essentially one-third of all radio station owners across the country. They're just out of business. And again, what's happened in this industry is these are massive publicly traded corporations who, ironically, are not really broadcasters in the traditional sense. You know, Clear Channel, who's the dominant player, is an advertising company. I mean, they made their money and their you know, sort of, you know, great successes in outdoor advertising. Now, basically, the most of the corporations who control these stations, these licenses, really just see themselves as conduits to try to use the, you know, the publicly traded or public spectrum as a way to get consumers in front of advertisers. And so consumers have really rebelled against this. And with the introduction of satellite radio and the sort of evolution of internet radio and sort of new technologies like the iPod, radio listenership is down and the time spent listening to radio is down, commercial radio. And so now radio is really facing, the radio broadcast industry is really facing an interesting set of decisions. Future Music Coalition has come forward with kind of a what we think is a fairly simple four-part agenda for what positive things could be done if Congress and the FCC actually decide to do something positive. You know, we think there's sort of four things that could be done that would revitalize the radio industry and really make better use of what is a very unusual and a very important public resource. The first is we need to hold the line in consolidation. And obviously, in reality, we need to roll back consolidation. We need to break up Clear Channel, and we need to kind of blow this thing up and start over. We're not in a political environment where that's really feasible. But at the very least, we need to hold the line on consolidation. And it's very interesting that the chairman of the House Telecommunications Subcommittee recently called for, asked Kevin Martin, the chair of the FCC, to actually boost the local ownership, the caps in local radio ownership from 8 up to as many as 12, which would just allow for more consolidation. So the first piece is we need to hold the line on consolidation. Mm-hmm. The second is we really need government policies that expand and protect non-commercial radio, because this really is the key. I mean, to a certain extent, commercial radio in the last 25 years has been a mixed bag, even pre-consolidation. But commercial radio is where there's a tremendous amount of energy and there's a lot of good work going on. So not only do we need a fully funded and an independent public media sector, we really need to have public radio where it's truly independent and has the resources it needs to really fulfill its original vision. But we also have to look at other alternatives like low-power radio, and we need Congress to pass legislation that would allow low-power licenses to be offered in urban markets. And we need the FCC to install policies that protect existing low-power radio stations. The third thing we need to do is we need to end this practice of institutionalized payola. And we can talk about that in more detail in a minute.
Yeah, definitely. I want to get to that later.
Yeah, but this is what Elliot Spitzer's been looking at. This is what Jonathan Adelstein at the FCC has been talking about for years. Basically, these are fundamental structural corrupt practices that do not play songs on radio, but they make it impossible for local or independent music to get onto commercial playlists, and we can talk about that in more detail. The fourth piece is that we are going through a transition to digital radio, in some ways similar to what we're doing in television, but using different technology and a different strategy. We need to make sure that this transition to HD radio, which has the potential net effect of doubling or tripling the amount of local radio stations in any given community, that this happens and takes place in a way that actually benefits consumers and citizens. Instead, what the FCC and the Congress are doing is they're just handing this additional spectrum, in essence, over to the existing broadcasters so they can do more of the same. So we need those. Those are the four pieces that we're working on. I'm sorry to just kind of dump all it out there.
I want our listeners to know all these things will be on the final exam at the end of the year.
Good.
Our guest today on Media Matters is Michael Bracey from the Future of Music Coalition. You're listening to Media Matters. Of course, I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here on WILL AM 580. We're coming to you live today. So please call in if you have any questions or comments. The phone line here, 333-9455. Our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. The lines are open if you do want to call in. Upcoming shows, next week we're going to have Sundiata Chajua talking about the Black Power Movement in a major conference coming up here on campus at the University of Illinois at the end of the month. After that, we've got Janine Jackson, Larry Lessig, Sasha Meinrath talking about community internet. Got a lot of great shows lined up, so stay tuned to Media Matters in the coming weeks. Michael Bracey, you've been talking about the agenda of radio reform or music reform to protect music on radio that you've been dealing with at the Future of Music Coalition. Let's go to that payola issue right now that you referred to, because that has gotten, in the industry at least, a great deal of attention because New York State Attorney General Elliot Spitzer, who's now running for governor of the state of New York, just launched a major campaign. Or why don't you take it from here? What is going on there?
Well, essentially what's happened in commercial radio is that as it became more and more consolidated, the historical form of payola morphed into a much more...
You should explain what payola is. I suspect some of our listeners are not familiar with that term.
No, exactly. Payola is bribery. And from the beginning of the radio industry, there has always been the interest in from a record label or a musician or an agent to get a song on the radio. And the traditional definition of payola, the way we think about it, is a DJ or a music director or program director being bribed to play a song. And this was outlawed by Congress 45 years ago. And it still has always continued. You know, the cliche was, you know, is cocaine and girls, you know, in the 70s. I mean, there's always been some aspect of attempts to unduly and illegally influence playlist decisions. But what happened in the consolidated marketplace is really interesting. In the last 10 years, as these stations were bought up, and they went from smaller locally owned decentralized companies into larger corporations, the bottom line pressures just grew and grew and grew. And the industry, the broadcast industry across the board, started to look for what's called non-traditional revenue. Radio used to make most of its money in advertising. They were desperate to find other revenue streams. And what they hit upon was a form called pay-for-play, which basically is a payola-like practice. And the way it worked is that a radio company, let's just take Entercom, for example, because they came up this week in Spitzer's investigation. What Entercom would do is they would basically cut off access to the program directors, and they would limit it to what are called certain radio promoters. Now, the interesting thing about these promoters is that they basically would pay for the right to be the exclusive voice, the exclusive contact that the radio station would listen to. So, for example, if I wanted to work out a deal with your station and you ran you're part of the Entercom chain, I would pay you $80,000. And what that meant was you would only talk to me. Then what would happen on the other side is that anybody who wanted to get a song on this radio station would then have to hire that promoter to be the conduit, basically. So you would have, basically it was a money laundering operation, where you had one piece of money going from the record label to the promoter to pay for basically the services of that promoter to try to get that song played on radio stations. Then different money going from a promoter to a radio station. And it came out to be roughly about $150 million. I mean, this turned into fairly large sums of money. Now, what happened is that this did not, you were not able to buy your way onto the air. Radio station playlists in commercial radio are typically built not by a strong programmer who has an instinct for a song that someone would like to listen to. They're done through testing and focus groups and call-out research and really kind of poor ways of programming radio stations, but that's a different story. But what this payola practice did is it limited which songs were eligible for airplay. If you were not working with a company that participated in this practice, your song had virtually no shot of getting on commercial air. And so that is one of the major reasons, again, I think that you've seen this flourishing of satellite radio, of internet radio, of these other technologies, in part because they present different content. They play different songs. Commercial radio really got bogged down into this sort of, homogenized, kind of same-sounding stuff that was coming out of the major labels, over the last 7 or 8 years. And you really didn't have a lot of the excitement and the diversity and the energy that you're seeing in the independent sector right now.
Now, Michael Bracey, before we turn to what Elliot Spitzer and
yep.
Jonathan Adelstein at the FCC are doing about this rise of payola in the music industry and radio, you're listening to Media Matters today on WILL AM 580 from Urbana, Illinois. I am your host, Bob McChesney. Our guest today is Michael Bracey, who is a co-founder of the Future of Music Coalition. And Michael Bracey has been very active in a number of crucial fights to protect the rights and interests of musicians. Michael, what's your website if people want to learn more about the Future of Music Coalition?
Yeah, that's great. They should go to www.futureofmusic.org.
Futureofmusic.org, okay. And we were talking just now before we went to the weather break about the payola scandal that's hit radio, and you were about to take us up to what Attorney General Spitzer of New York and the SEC are doing about it.
Yeah, what's interesting about this, Bob, is that in 2002, the entire music industry, and when I say that, I mean all the artist groups and even the RIAA, even the industry itself, the Recording Industry Association itself, came forward with a joint statement that said that radio consolidation has had a devastating impact on the music community. And one of the biggest problems is this institutionalized payola. And we were very public, and this was very well covered, and all the newspapers picked it up, and it was big news. Jonathan Adelstein came out of the commission, roughly a year and a half later. And as an FCC commissioner, he spoke publicly about this time after time. So we have to do something about payola. We have to do something about payola. Of course, all, that the FCC leadership wanted to do was to find ways to further deregulate. They didn't want to take care of payola. They didn't want to look at the impact of the existing consolidation. Attorney General Spitzer in New York became aware of this issue and aware of the impact that this payola was having both on listeners and also on musicians in the state of New York, and he undertook an investigation. And what he found was that all you had to do was subpoena the correct records. It was very easy. It was all there in black and white and paper trail. And so Spitzer launched an investigation. He negotiated settlements with two of the major record labels. There are two other settlements that are likely to come down soon. But most importantly, in the last 60 days, he has turned the investigation to what he said from the beginning is where the real problem was, that it was not, a situation where the record labels were trying to bribe broadcasters. It was really a situation where the broadcasters were putting making it necessary for the record labels to put this money out there.
They were shaking them down.
They were shaking them down, exactly. Yeah. And so what Spitzer's done now is he has filed suit against Intercom Broadcasting. There are potential other suits coming. But his question is, where is the FCC? And Jonathan Adelstein's question is, where is the FCC? Our question is, where is the FCC? Instead of continuing this trend we've seen in the last 6 years in this commission of trying to deregulate, they have to be accountable for the practices that have happened under their nose that they've been well aware of. This has not been happening in the dark.
We're talking about an actual violation of law here. I mean, this isn't like some vague issue.
Oh, absolutely. There are two. The FCC has got two choices, and really, they can either follow the law and say these were illegal practices, they shouldn't have happened. We're going to negotiate settlements. We're going to hold these people accountable, and we're going to put tough policies in to make sure this doesn't happen again, or they have to go to Congress and say, you know what, gang, you know, we think this actually was legal under existing law, and you need to update the law. And to date, they've done neither.
We're talking to Michael Bracey today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Michael Bracey works with the Future of Music Coalition. Our number here, if you wish to call in, 333-9455, toll-free 1-800-222-9455. Let's go to the phone lines now. San Francisco, you're on the air with Michael Bracey.
Hello, could you guess? I'm a hardcore radio fan. That's why I tune in here every single week. But I just wanted to comment, it was so refreshing this week to hear on Democracy Now! Chelsea Morning by Joni Mitchell, you know, close to that interview with Minister Ben from the UK, but it was so refreshing. I looked it up, I wondered what happened to Joni Mitchell. I looked it up on the internet and found out she's calling the music industry a cesspool today. But I just also wanted to call and mention two things that I think are great places to learn about independent music. Two of my favorite websites. One is Whole Wheat Radio up in Talkeetna, Alaska. Their website's wholewheatradio.org. The other one is Kulak's Woodshed down in L.A., where they stream independent music. And they've been targeted by the city and the music industry for what they're doing. If it weren't for stations like that, I wouldn't know about some really great musicians like, say, David Rovix, who's playing in San Francisco tonight at 8 o'clock. But I just wanted to call and make those comments. Hope you don't mind.
Well, I guess we all know what we're doing tonight in San Francisco.
Thanks.
Well, thank you very much for calling. Well, you know, that's an interesting point the caller made about Joni Mitchell. I mean, what has been the response of working musicians to the Future of Music Coalition? I mean, what is the relationship of working musicians to the recording industry and the radio industry?
Well, it's very complicated. And, you know, there are all the cliches about herding cats and things like that. And there's some truth to it, in part because there are so many different layers in the industry in terms of how successful you've been. Obviously, for the very, very few musicians who have been successful in the traditional industry, this transition is difficult and it's hard, and they're seeing revenue go away. You know, the old ways of getting paid may not be the same ways that get paid in the future. By and large, though, you know, most musicians that we deal with certainly embrace a lot of what technology is bringing and the ideas of reforming radio will bring. Because really what we're trying to build is as I said, a much more equitable music economy, especially one that allows a musician, for example, just to be able to preserve their copyright. Right now, if you sign a major label deal, you know, the only way you could get on commercial radio is to sign with a major label. Well, they take your copyright. You know, you would have a very, very punitive contract you'd be forced to sign. The standard contract was very punitive and not very fair. And so a lot of musicians would rather try to find a balance where they could keep control of their career, keep control of their decisions, keep costs down in terms of marketing costs, things like that, but also try to be compensated to the point where they can make a living. And that's the difficult balance.
Michael Bracey, you just mentioned copyright. That's really the, you know, two-ton elephant in any discussion of the internet and music. The downloading of music without the permission of the copyright holder has been probably the major story of the internet and music for the last decade. And it's really seems to be the central tension that exists between commercial music industry and the internet, because it is so easy to copy and disseminate and distribute music without having the permission of the person who creates the music.
Mm-hmm.
Where does this stand now? Is this problem going to be solved by technology? What is the Future of Music Coalition position on the issue of copyright?
Well, I don't know that there's any sort of one black and white, you know, kind of position on it. I think in general, what we have been calling for since the introduction of peer-to-peer, you know, our response to the original Napster would say the only antidote to this is a legal Napster. That what you have to do is look at technology as a way of fundamentally restructuring the economy, but find ways to monetize that economy. And we're actually incredibly optimistic about what has happened in the last, you know, 3 to 4 years in terms of legitimate services and legitimate ways of distributing and purchasing music online, that you're starting to see, you know, Apple just sold their billionth download. You're starting to see consumers actually spending money to access this music, and those money is then flowing back through toward the musician. So our general focus is that whatever However the marketplace evolves, you know, it's absolutely critical that you have legitimate licensed services, that music is available legally, and that's the antidote to sort of illegal black market, sort of, you know, in sort of capitalism terms, black market, you know, transmission of music. But the big issue, you know, as you all know, and I'm sure you've been, you know, talking to your listeners about the last, you know, couple of years, I mean, the, you know, the big issue is to make sure that as we migrate away from traditional media, as broadcast is sort of replaced by future technologies, that we don't, that the government does not allow similar structures to emerge. And this is the whole question of net neutrality. You know, one of the big issues right now being debated in Washington, and in fact there is likely to be new legislation coming out this week out of the House of Representatives. One of the big issues is whether or not, instead of Clear Channel being able to pick and choose what songs get on the radio, you instead have companies like AT&T or Verizon or Comcast with the legal authority to pick and choose what websites or what services their consumers are able to go to and access, and whether we're going to allow alternate ways of reaching the Internet that aren't simply going through the big telephone companies or the big cable companies, whether or not cities or counties have the right to build their own wireless structures, like I know you have in your community.
We do indeed.
Yep. So that, you know, those are really the big issues. And I think the experience of the music industry is so interesting because it demonstrates that not only is there an enormous amount of content and ideas and art and culture that people want to make available, but also that consumers and citizens want to go get that content, and it has nothing to do with these traditional entertainment companies or media companies. I mean, it really happens in a very organic and grassroots way. This is a very, very important thing for our culture. It's a very important thing for our economy, and it's important that policymakers don't get in the way and simply, you know, give these unbalanced rights essentially over to these large corporations.
So copyright law, as I understand it, over the past 50 or 100 years, the major changes have been that it's been extended to corporations holding the copyrights as well as individuals, artists in this case, or book authors otherwise, on one hand. And also the length of the copyright term has been extended dramatically.
Right.
So it's well beyond the lifetime of the musician or the author.
Right.
Do you think that's an issue, or should we have virtually permanent copyrights for musicians on their music, or should there be a time length in how long a musician holds a copyright before someone else can play the music without compensating them?
Well, I mean, that's an enormously complicated question. In general, we feel Future Music Coalition is very unusual in terms of an organization that works with artists and sort of represents the interests of artists, and we actually are concerned that this, you know, sort of constant extension of copyright has really been counterproductive to what is really in the best interest of artists, and we get in trouble for saying that because that's sort of a contrarian position. But yeah, you know, the concern is clearly that, you know, copyrights have in many ways been abused. I mean, copyright has been in the traditional music industry has really been a way of these four companies to essentially amass copyrights. You know, they collect them, and that's really been one of the major ways that they've been able to control the distribution of music and really set the parameters of what the music economy would look like. And as we move into this digital age, you know, that creates, you know, new opportunities that we're not, you know, we're not around in part because because of copyright and because companies are able to essentially turn, essentially abuse the notion of copyright and turn it into side businesses. The simple answer, if this isn't even really a simple answer, but the simplest answer I think I could give is that there are what's happening now and what will continue to happen over the next couple decades is so phenomenally complicated and interconnected because what we're looking at is the evolution of innovation combined with policy, combined with business ideas, combined with consumer behavior, you know, all these things factor together, and copyright plays into that. What we want, again, is a world where a musician has the ability to create their art, has the ability to make their work available to consumers, that they have the ability to be compensated for their art and for their creation, and hopefully be compensated at a level where if their art is good enough, I mean, if it really can find a market, they could make a living. And, you know, we talk a lot about the musician's middle class because most people, I don't think, have a sense of sort of the abject poverty that the overwhelming majority of musicians, working musicians, live in. And then if you gave a musician, you told them you'd give them a deal where they'd make enough money they could buy a mortgage, they could have a house, if they could have health care, you know, insurance for their family, and if they could get in radio in their hometown, they think that's an awfully good deal. So that's really what we're dealing with. And copyright and, you know, corporate abuse of copyright and copyright in a digital age and other issues like sampling and mashups and sort of the, you know, the way that digital technology creates all sorts of new possibilities for creation of art that copyright law doesn't really account for. These are all very interesting and complicated issues that there are no easy answers to.
Michael Bracey, our guest today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Michael, we've only got a little over 10 minutes left, and there's a few things I'd like to talk about that aren't all entirely related, but things I've always wanted to ask you, so I'm going to take advantage of my position here to do that. You know, back in the 1960s, dating myself now, when I listened to what was then called Top 40 radio, which are sort of the popular hits, one of the things that was interesting about it was that, you know, if you look at the top 40 list for, say, 1965, any given week, you would find rock and roll songs, country songs, what's called soul music. You'd find basically a lot of different genres intermixed. And if you were to listen to one of the top 40 stations in any American community then, there are usually several in every town, you would hear a mixture of songs. And something I've grown to appreciate in my older age because I no longer see it anywhere was that it sort of exposed me to a lot of stuff I wouldn't have been exposed to otherwise. That I would, you know, I sort of heard country music I would never voluntarily listen to. And it certainly exposed me to some incredible soul music I never would have heard probably otherwise. Is there some, I mean, you might not, you know, I don't know if anyone else thinks that's a problem, but is there a way people can get exposure to a lot of different genres now that is emerging? Because certainly commercial radio has been so, you know, segmented.
Exactly.
That's impossible now. Where is that something that will ever come back, or is that notion gone that we can have some source we go to just get general exposure to new music across genres?
Yeah, that's a really great question. And that goes to, you know, sort of what I referenced earlier, that the idea of having music companies in the abstract is there's some potential benefits there, because what we are missing as the economy, I mean, it's fundamentally good. I mean, what's happening in the music economy is a very, very good development. But the downside of it is that people are sort of gravitating towards their own niches. And so as you, as a consumer, become, have the potential to become exposed to any music you would ever want to listen to very quickly, what we're losing in music, but we also are losing in television and other forms of media, is we are losing a sort of major cultural touchstones that everybody rallies around, that everybody knows about. And it's going to be very interesting to see, and it's more sort of a cultural or a popular studies, you know, kind of pop culture question that I'm not really, you know, qualified to answer, but it'll be interesting to see how culturally we adapt to that and what sort of you know, where we come out. If we are, as consumers, over the next couple of decades, just going to kind of all race off in our own niches and follow our own thing. I mean, one thing that is happening, which is very neat, is that, again, because of technology and because of the net, the traditional notion of the local community that would come together is being replaced by sort of virtual communities. And this week, for example, the Austin, Texas is hosting the annual South by Southwest Music Conference. And this year it actually is going to have the largest turnout ever, and there are going to be thousands of bands. But when you go to South by Southwest, what you'll find is that all these bands who have small followings or limited followings in all these different communities, all these people are able to come together, you know, at Austin, and these bands are huge. They'll play for, you know, thousands of people. And so, you know, the Scottish artist Momus had this great line, you know, years ago, where he said, in the future, everybody will be famous for 15 people. And that's really where we're going, is at these niches. But I am concerned, I think we should be concerned, that particularly in the music space, we may be losing the benefits of having those great big monster hits that we all know and we all can relate to.
And this leads to something else that has changed since the 1960s, and I don't know the exact figures here, but it's something of great interest to me, which is the fate of classical music. As I understand it, in 1960, roughly 20 to 25% of all recorded music sales were classical music in the United States. Today, I don't know what the figure is, but I suspect it's significantly lower. 1%, 2%, 3%, 4%, I don't know. You would know the figures, I don't. Why is that? What has happened that has made classical music so much less popular to consumers?
Well, in the last decade, what we've seen, there's actually a very good report that talked about, basically documented the way that radio played a very, very important role in the classical music industry, because radio became the primary connector and the primary way that a local classical music fan would stay connected to both classical music and to their local art scene. And one of the outgrowths of radio consolidation is that there are virtually no commercial classical radio stations anymore. And part of the problem that public radio is facing is because of funding pressures, they are also going away from classical radio. So classical has essentially disappeared, and we see it with other genres, but it's not on broadcast radio. Now, what has happened is, of course, with the implementation of satellite radio and the Internet, that now classical music fans are finding ways of accessing, you know, the music they love, and that's really, you know, helping give a boost. But we haven't seen, you know, yet, which we are going to see, I hope, is the role that local radio stations, and as technology continues, you know, as we get away from traditional ideas of radio and, you know, just sort of local content that's delivered over different means, but as the idea of radio and radio-like technologies being the local hub that can really create a platform for promoting and evangelizing on behalf of a local classical arts community.
Michael Bracey, now let's return to the point of departure of the show, which is the future of music. You know, what, looking down the road 5-10 years, I mean, will there be record stores, as we used to call them, anymore? Will there be, or will everything be digital? What do you see as the likely future of music in the United States, say in the year 2015 or 2020?
Well, the first thing to get out front is to state out front is that, of course, music is it's essentially part of being human, and music is about communication, and it's not simply, you know, something that you can commodify and turn into a retail product. And so music always has been a big part of people's lives, will continue to be a big part of people's lives. In the immediate future, what we're seeing in retail and the way that music that consumers respond to the music industry is that the sort of implosion of the major label system and the implosion of commercial radio has also really had a real negative impact on what we call sort of like the mall record stores. You know, the record stores that were based in shopping malls or, sort of national chains that really catered to a top 40 marketplace and were really built around not serving the most educated music fan. The other aspect of that is the sort of growth of the big box music retailers and that, you know, Best Buy and Walmart and sort of the very, very aggressive pricing that they would use with some of the top hits. That is really killed that kind of mid-level retail. But what's happening on the other side of that is that as more and more music is available and as consumers are finding more and more ways of accessing music, what they're also finding is that they are going to need even more in the future. They're going to need translators and guides. They're going to need editors who can help turn them on to the next thing that they would like. And in many ways, this creates a wonderful opportunity, which we're seeing in a lot of markets, for a rebirth of independent local retail, where you know, the traditional idea of, you know, the record clerk that you can go and you say, hey, you know, I love this record. What else should I get? I love The Replacements. What should I be listening to? And so in some ways, local retailers that look at music, music as being more than simply, you know, a widget, you know, as looking at music as something that's part of a community and part of sort of the local culture, have a chance to, you know, really do well. Now, longer term, again, we have to see what decisions are made and what happens with broadband deployment and net neutrality and all these other issues. But longer term, you know, consumers are, you know, going to become more and more comfortable with purchasing digital content. They're going to, you know, the technology will be a lot easier, that you can actually download supplemental material, so you can get lyrics and you can get posters, you can get all the stuff you'll be able to download and print on your own. And so, everything is going to become more and more sort of decentralized and digitized. But that's essentially going to be, we think, a really good thing. Again, because all the investment is going to have to go into the creation of the work and the marketing promotion of the work, but it's not going to have to go into the physical cost of moving things on trucks and things like that, which should make it more possible for more musicians and more independent labels to compete in the market.
Michael Bracey, our guest today in Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. We're in our waning moments here today in WILL AM 580 for today's program. Future of Music Coalition, I mean, a lot of the work you do is advocating musicians' interest on Capitol Hill, at the FCC, in Congress, whatever it takes to push what you regard as the important issues facing musicians. And you personally, Michael Bracey, are a lobbyist working for Bracey Tucker Brown in Washington, D.C. Mm-hmm. What are the core political issues that people concerned about music will be following this year that you'll be covering at the Future of Music Coalition website?
The first clearly is going to be, I shouldn't put these in order of importance because they're all important, but obviously the rewrite of the Telecommunications Act. Congress is in the middle of very intensive negotiations. It's unclear where things stand right at this moment. The assumption is that legislation will not be passed this year, but certainly legislation has been proposed, is going to be debated, and it's going to be very, very important for citizens to keep a close eye on this, particularly since we're in an election year, and members of Congress and people who are up for election in the Senate are much more accessible and accountable in an election year than in other years. So the first is going to be the rewrite of the Telecommunications Act. The second is all the issues that the FCC potentially is dealing with in terms of media ownership, who can own radio stations. We're going through this transition, as I mentioned, to HD radio. Will radio stations be allowed to multicast and have no accountability as far as what they put on their additional digital streams? Issues like that are of great importance.
Well, Michael, in terms of HD radio, the transition from traditional analog radio broadcasting to high definition or digital radio, mm-hmm. is that before Congress or the FCC, or where is that being deliberated?
That is currently at the FCC. The FCC has a pending decision which has been held up for over a year by Commissioner Adelstein and others, but they have a pending decision that would essentially write the rules that would say, this is what Clear Channel, this is what you can do with this additional spectrum. You know, you can do whatever you want on one hand, or you have to work with local community organizations, or you have to do something to open up the spectrum for other people. So that's the range of decisions
so
that the FCC has.
If people are, our listeners are concerned about this, should they be in touch with Commissioner Adelstein, or what should they do?
Well, I know you have a very educated and astute listenership. There is a open proceeding at the FCC, and if you go to the FCC website and search for HD radio, you can find information about that. You could still file comments, but you also can contact the FCC commissioners and express your concerns that this be done right. The simple thing, though...
But you know, Michael, I've just got the news from on high that we're almost out of time. As you can hear, the musicians are in the studio, and Tavis Smiley's queuing up to step in. Michael Bracey, I want to thank you for joining me today in Media Matters. It's been a great show. We'll be in touch again. I'm Bob McChesney. I want to thank Andrew Boyle and Brett Polson. See you next week.